Hello, KRTS listeners, and thank you for joining us at Marfa Public Radio. That's 93.5 on your FM dial. Welcome to the Talk at 10 interview show. I am Jason Kolker, sometimes known by my nickname Oslo around town. And this is the Thought Train edition of Talk at 10, where we tend to look into an idea and roll it around a bit. And the idea we'll be investigating today is the power of DNA. For DNA for forensics, for DNA exoneration. I guess that's part of the same thing. It's the 25th anniversary of one of the very first DNA cases. It's the 10th anniversary of, I think, fair to call it, the legendary LAPD cold case unit. And if we have a few minutes towards the end of the show, maybe I can ask our guests a little bit about the local break-ins that I had been reading about in the paper. So we are joined by two distinguished guests. Both of them have been immersed in DNA studies, I guess you could call it, in completely different ways, one from the journalism side and one from the cold case, from the investigative police force side. We have Matthew McGough, who wrote a piece for The Atlantic a couple of months ago about an ongoing DNA investigation concerning the LAPD, and that's the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, both as prosecution and defendant. And Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for having me on, Jason.
Sure. Well, I'll give you more intro. How about that? More recently, he has the cover story of this month's Miller McCune magazine with a story entitled, or at least the cover is entitled Catching Cold Case Killers. But I think, what is your story exactly called?
It's called Not Forgotten, and it's the story of the genesis of the LAPD's cold case unit, which is 10 years old this month.
Well, that's a great segue, because that story then is largely about our second guest, and that's Mr. David Lampkin, who is a retired LAPD homicide detective and the original officer in charge of the LAPD's cold case unit. And Mr. Lampkin, can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can. Yeah, pleasure to be on with you today.
Okay, well, you sound loud and clear, and you are calling from quite a distance away. You're not in Los Angeles. Where are you?
I'm actually living in a small Victorian seaport town up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State.
If you say the words or the letters LAPD, do people know what you're talking about, or do you have to explain it to them?
No, absolutely. Everybody knows LAPD. Probably kind of stems out of all the television shows that have been over the years done, you know, involving our department going way back to Dragnet. So it's certainly well known all over the world.
Right. I'm honor-bound to explain that DNA is the blueprint of life. And I learned that in high school, way back when in the 80s. And around that time, there were a bunch of promises about DNA. There were these little genetic creatures we saw in Blade Runner. There was talk that guys like me would never go bald because DNA would save us from such a fate. And there was, you know, talk about mysterious junk DNA, and, you know, we would finally solve that and get to the nuts and bolts and the bottom of what DNA can do for us. Well, in my opinion, almost every one of those promises has not been fulfilled to satisfaction except for one. And that is the idea that you could solve a crime or you could exonerate someone from a crime simply by matching or not matching DNA found at a crime scene. I have this question then to lead off. Why is it that so much of DNA is still a mystery, except that for forensics, DNA is a magic bullet?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a magic bullet, and it really changed the entire landscape as to how cases were investigated. Prior to having this tool, in a case, whether it was DNA or even fingerprints, detectives used to have to go out there, beat the pavement, and come up with a suspect, and then either biological evidence would be taken from that suspect for ABO blood typing or fingerprints, and then you would go back and match them to the crime scene. So it was up to the detective to really come up with a suspect for comparison. I used to laugh on TV shows, and it's a little off subject, but, you know, they'd show someone at a crime scene in the 70s or 80s and come up with a fingerprint, and by some magic process, the lab guys could come up with a suspect for him from that fingerprint. Well, it really didn't work that way because we didn't have the computers we have these days. It was virtually impossible to come up with a suspect. As I said, now the whole landscape has changed because now we send fingerprints or DNA to the lab, and because of these new databases that have come into use across the United States, it's now the criminalist who call us and give us a suspect name.
And is the idea that we know very, very well what DNA looks like, even if we don't know what each particular gene does, and that's why genetic engineering has moved a little bit more slowly than genetic forensics?
The DNA is extremely complex, but for law enforcement purposes, we only look at 13 loci of the DNA and work from those. So because there's so much information in a single strand of DNA, I think, and you're in the same boat I am, I'm bald also just about, I think it's much more difficult to determine exactly which part of that DNA connects up with what particular thing you're interested in. For forensic uses, we look at 13 loci, and we work from those.
Matthew, I'm going to get you in just a second, but I want to clarify something with David Lampkin here. Basically, we're trying to match 13 separate numbers, so to speak. They're letters that we call them letters, but they're proteins. But the point that I want to emphasize is that the chances, if you match each one of those, would be, correct me if I'm wrong, we're 13 times 12 times 11 times 10, some enormous number of likelihood. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, it gets up in literally the trillions. And, you know, there's various combinations within those. I mean, we've gotten numbers back on frequencies that are so big, I mean, there's no name for them. I mean, that's why DNA has become virtually a tool for identification, just like fingerprints have, because you get numbers back that there aren't that many people on the planet.
Right.
Which is, I just want to add, you know, up until we got DNA, we were doing the old ABO blood grouping, and, you know, the best you could do with that was, well, you know, this guy could be your suspect, but it's whatever the blood grouping came back as, you know, 40% of the population have this, so it's not, wasn't very good in terms of identification.
I just also want to add on that idea that, you know, what David said about how DNA analysis has supplanted serological, which is blood and blood type testing, is that before I started looking into the subject, I think I had the misapprehension, and I think a lot of people do, that DNA is static somehow. You know, even it's three letters, it's so simple that it's the same as it was in 1986 when this first case, a murder case, was eventually solved by it, and that the state of DNA forensics in 1986 would be the same as 10 years after that or today, that the science is being constantly refined and improved, and it's possible to get, you know, for investigators to get a workable DNA sample from lesser amount of crime scene evidence than may have been necessary 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, and it will continue to improve, which seems right to me. The police departments will evolve to take advantage of that.
I'm going to bounce around a little bit. So I hear what you're saying. We'll go back to that because I want to know about what the improvements are. It's, I think, largely improvements in efficiency of processing DNA, and we'll get to that in a moment. But this is the 25th anniversary of the first case of, I guess, real case of DNA forensic usage, and I know about it from your story in The Atlantic a few months back. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a case that popularly is known as the blooding, and I should give credit to one of my writing idols, Joseph Wamba, who was in fact a LAPD detective before he became a crime writer, and he wrote the definitive book about this case, and it's called The Blooding. But with that caveat, it details a murder investigation, a serial murder investigation in England that unfolded 25 years ago this fall, in which police arrested a suspect who he had some mental and emotional problems, and he confessed to one of two murders of these two teenage girls who had been killed and sexually assaulted, but he refused to admit to the other one. And they were convinced that this suspect had committed both murders, but as David said earlier, the blood testing evidence was inconclusive. They couldn't conclusively say whether he had done it or not. And one of the police detectives recalled reading about some research that a local geneticist had been doing, specifically something called a genetic fingerprint. And they contacted this professor and asked him to test the crime scene evidence to confirm that this guy had in fact killed both women. However, when they got the results back, his DNA fingerprint, as it was called at the time, was discovered to match neither of the crime scenes, including the one that he had confessed to. So, in fact, the first criminal suspect ever submitted for DNA analysis was exonerated by it. And eventually, when they did identify a suspect, DNA confirmed that it matched both of these crime scenes, and that guy, whose name very oddly, is Colin Pitchfork, became the first murderer in human history convicted due to DNA evidence, and that was in England in 1986.
How big was that town?
It was two very small suburbs of probably 10 to 15,000 people total outside of a city called Leicester City of about 300,000.
Interesting. And Mr. Lampkin, I know you asked me to call you David, but I'm just so used to referring to police officers as Mr. that might happen again.
Okay, no problem.
when you started the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department's cold case unit, did you know about that case?
Yeah, I sure did. Yeah, you know, Joseph Wamba, you know, is ex-LAPD, like they said. And also we actually have some people in my unit that know Joseph pretty well. So I was aware of it.
David, I have a question. Do you have any recollection of hearing about it at the time?
I have no recollection of hearing about it at the time. No, I didn't hear about that case till later on down the road.
It seems to me that case is as pivotal as, you know, the invention of the personal computer or something, because DNA is incredibly invasive. Even though we can get it from a hair or a lipstick trace, literally a lipstick trace, it is incredibly invasive. It tells more about us than anything else. And here, for the first time, it's used to put someone in jail for, you know, life, I would assume.
You know, invasive is a loaded term. I mean, it's a very complex thing that has been introduced as a tool. And, you know, there's lots of arguments that can be made analogizing it to other tools that investigators use. And that's just, we're speaking strictly of DNA's application in criminal investigations. As you acknowledge, Jason, there's vast medical and many other dimensions to DNA in general. But yes, I do think it's pretty much impossible to underestimate the seismic shift that we're 25 years into. You know, fingerprints came into common acceptance as an investigative tool around 1901, which is when Scotland Yard kind of condoned its use, and then other police departments around the world adopted it. I mean, 25 years from 1901 is, it's like we're in the jazz age. You know, it wasn't until 70, 80 years later that fingerprint databases, like David said, even, you know, there was nothing to do with the fingerprint if you had it, if you didn't have a suspect, until very, very recently.
Matthew, let me interrupt, because I want to ask David a question relating to that. Given how recent fingerprint databases were, and then you start doing cold case unit with DNA, were there law enforcement agents who were suspicious of what you were doing, maybe didn't have the faith in it that you did, or one step further, were they jealous because they thought, here's this guy who opens up his own unit, this cold case unit, going back over stuff that we missed, and he's got new weapons that we would never have even dreamt of?
Well, realistically, I mean, within the realm of the Los Angeles Police Department, once we got the databases in place and we started to get a little bit of support from our scientific division, which still is an issue, but really these tools were somewhat available to everybody. But, I mean, there was a little resentment once we got our unit going, because once we got into it a little bit, we eventually got it to the point that on any old case, it would have to go through our unit to give the approval or to put it in the queue at the appropriate place. So that became a bit of a problem with some of the divisions who wanted to look at their older cases. But, you know, we were sitting on 9,000 unsolved cases in the city of Los Angeles going back to 1960. And so there was no shortage of cases to go around. So we would work with the individual divisions. But the fact is, most of those divisions didn't have any personnel to look at these cases anyway. That's why I pushed so long for the cold case unit. And even once DNA was up and running, even in high-profile cases, our support was so poor from our scientific division. I mean, it could take a year to get DNA done, even on a high-profile case.
Was your DNA, the LAPD DNA, one of the first ones in existence?
Actually, Chicago had one up and running, as I recall, and New York. Matthew might even know that answer better than I do.
I do think there were a couple that predated the LAPD, but I would say that you know, I don't think there's a police department in the country that has the track record that the LAPD cold case unit does in its first decade, which, you know, like I said, it was 10 years ago this month, and it was that it went operational. And in that time, the unit has directly arrested 7 individual serial killers who were out on the street.
Wow.
Or at least had not been called to account for collectively more than 40 murders that in 2001, when the unit went operational, were unsolved.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. Who is the TV show developed? Was that based on the Los Angeles PD cold case unit?
No, that was out of Philadelphia, I think, is where that took place, if I recall correctly.
No, but that was fictionalized.
Right.
Yeah,
but
was it based on the LAPD?
To be honest, I thought from a realistic standpoint, it was a really poor show, and I'm not sure it was based on much of anything.
Right.
Other than writer's imagination.
Hey, I have a question for both of you. I wonder if, when you're writing about this, or David Lampkin, when you were investigating this stuff, if you would ever get so caught up in the cutting-edge science of what you were doing that you somehow lost track, that you were dealing with just heartbreaking murders and losses that would just be felt for decades to come by their family.
Absolutely. You know, that was really always at the forefront of myself and everyone who worked for me. That's the whole reason why I brought this unit up, was to bring some sort of hope for these families that they would eventually find out what happened to their loved ones. And I don't use the word closure, because if you deal with these families on a regular basis, you realize there's no such thing as closure. It's a fallacy. But to have these unanswered questions on the part of the family, that's why I fought so hard and Lisa Kahn fought so hard. Everything we did was for the families.
Matthew, what about yourself?
Yeah, I would just add, as a writer, yesterday, there's one of these serial killer investigations that I mentioned is a defendant named Lonnie Franklin, who is known in the media here locally as the Grim Sleeper serial killer case.
Sure.
And I was at a community forum yesterday in this neighborhood where over a period of about 28 years, he killed at least 16 women. And there was a meeting in a black church in the neighborhood where he both lived and killed so many people over the last 25 years. Well, he was arrested last year, and many family members of the victim were in attendance asking questions and wanting to know everything there was to know about the progress of the investigation. And it was very heartrending, and it's very, very important, I think, to remember what's at stake here. There's a lot of glamorization, I think, of cold case units, and I can see why, given what type of work they do. But fundamentally, they're dealing with these individual tragedies and trying to bring today's tools to bear on some of these questions that, you know, very likely would otherwise, you know, never be revisited by anyone.
You know, I would like to add, too, I know we're talking about DNA today, but we look at a lot of other cases that DNA may not have been a factor, and we reopen ones that even look like they could be solved just based on re-interviewing witnesses. And I can tell you the greatest satisfaction from this job came from dealing with the families. These are families that gave up, that thought nothing was ever going to be done. The police department was never going to look at the case again. And even some cases we never solved, the fact we looked at them 20 or 30 years later, these people were just so thankful. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. I mean, it's interesting. There are so many effective synonyms and euphemisms for what homicide investigation is. And homicide is even a euphemism now because it sounds so much more gentlemanly and detectively than just straight out murder. But if you deal with that all the time, I can imagine the emotional impact of it is just something that you can't avoid.
Right. And another side to that, too, first of all, there's a little point I want to make based on what Matthew said earlier. We used to sit around in the 90s saying, how come we haven't had any serial killers in the city of Los Angeles since, like, Richard Ramirez or whatever, you know, and people couldn't understand it. Well, the fact is we just weren't identifying them. Once we got this unit up, Matthew mentioned all these serial killers we identified. They were out there. We just didn't know they were out there.
Walk me through something. This was a question I had, and it seems to fit in well here. What is the process? You come to a crime scene, let's say. Let's say it's not a cold case. a current crime scene, and you have a history of working with sexual offenders. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's, let's say, an overturned chair. You have a victim speaking with some officers over to the side, and you find some evidence, maybe a hair or something like that. Or what? How does it go from there? Do you pick it up and you put it in a bag, or do you call people's attention to it and photograph?
Well, see, in Los Angeles, we're really lucky because we have a lot of field support. I mean, you get to smaller jurisdictions, it's up to that responding person, who may not even be a detective, to photograph the scene themselves and collect everything. What we do is we bring in criminalists to the crime scene, and, you know, there's always, you know, it's best if you know about all the different processes that can be involved, because just because someone's a criminalist doesn't mean they may not pick up on something. But essentially, we go through that crime scene and identify anything that might be good for fingerprints. We have people from Leighton Prince that come in and do that. We have a separate photography section that brings in forensic photographers. We have a separate responding criminalist that will pick up any biological evidence for you. So we're lucky in the fact we have people that work in the field that actually come to the crime scene. Now, anything directly related to the body, the coroner handles, and they have their own criminalists who you bring out. So it's a coordinated effort. And, you know, every crime scene is different, so it's hard to generalize. But like in sexual assault crime scenes, one of the things you want to do is bring in alternate light sources and lasers, for instance, because bodily fluids will glow under that, makes it easier to identify. And you just have to kind of sit back and take stock of what you're looking at and understand how offenders work. I mean, in some cases, offenders may kill their victim and then back off from the victim and fantasize and masturbate away from the victim. So you got to really, really be cognitive of anywhere in the room that you might have biological evidence. It's not necessarily going to be on your victim just because it's a sexual assault crime.
And once the evidence is collected, who owns it? Is it the police force then, or is it the victim's?
Ultimately, it's the police departments. Now, if something's collected by the criminalist from the coroner's office, from the body, and let's say there's a sexual assault, they would do essentially a sexual assault kit like you would on a living sexual assault victim. They do that at the coroner's office. Essentially, they would book it into their evidence room, but ultimately that would be transferred over to the LAPD evidence room for processing by our crime lab. So ultimately, our crime lab ends up with everything. It's just not necessarily always collected by them.
You know, folks, we only got 2 minutes left. Let me just, if I may, introduce a totally different topic, or maybe not totally different, but somewhat, which is Marfa, Texas, a small dot in our huge listening area. We're all of West Texas. We have 100,000 watts. But we broadcast from Marfa, and there have been a number of break-ins here. Some allegedly, I've read this in the paper, where the assailant or the breaker-inner has masturbated and left some evidence on clothing or what have you. And I'm interested to get your takes on it, but what would be the steps to go about finding the bad guy? And Matthew, my first question is to you. If you can get, you know, a town of 15,000 people in England in 1986 to submit DNA, couldn't we just do that?
You know, DNA David could speak, I'm sure, with more authority on this than me, but I think DNA dragnets are fairly rare in America. And one of the interesting aspects of how DNA forensics has evolved since the Blooding case, which, as I mentioned, was in England in 1986, is that law enforcement in England does things with DNA forensics that I think would make the ACLU pretty apoplectic here, but it's become accepted there. So the rules are just because something was done in England doesn't mean that it could be easily done or that it would be palatable to Americans, you know, at any given historical moment. But in terms of the case, I really, I have to defer to David.
Well, we have him here. So, David, what would you say?
Well, in a case like that, first of all, we can't do DNA sweeps here. You can go and voluntarily ask people for DNA samples. There's no legal issue doing that. But if you develop a suspect in a case like that, or you're going to have probable cause towards that particular suspect and then actually write a search warrant to collect the sample. So it is complicated and time-consuming. Now, some exceptions to that are what helps if you have people who were required to register under law as a sex registrant, and I don't know what the law is in Texas, but everybody in California who's a sex registrant has to provide a DNA sample and goes into a DNA data bank. So California has some of the most cutting-edge laws in terms of helping law enforcement on DNA. Same thing with arrestees. In California, all felony arrestees have to provide a DNA sample at the time of their arrest. It's not post-conviction like a lot of states, and I believe Texas may still be post-conviction. So we have a great advantage with that type of setup because we have a huge data bank and you have a lot of offenders in there. And once these laws started coming into effect that expanded it, we just saw the DNA hit rate go up like, just crazy. And so we do have an advantage there because let's say, for instance, in the case you're talking about, let's say they have someone they arrest for burglary that may or may not be their guy, but they don't have any probable cause for a search warrant for that particular case. He just gets arrested for burglary. A lot of burglaries get dropped down to trespasses when they go through the courts, and you could have someone who's your offender, got arrested for burglary in another jurisdiction, pleads out to a trespass, and his DNA may never go into the data bank if you don't have a collection at the time of arrest law. So there's a lot of factors that fall into that, but obviously in a case like that, DNA would be one of your number one tools, and then also fingerprints, you know.
How long does it take to test DNA, and how much does it cost to test DNA?
Well, the kind of going rate, if you send it out to a private lab, runs between $1,000 and $1,200 a sample, I believe it is now. Matthew might even have more current numbers.
That's news to me. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, we have our own lab, so they were doing it themselves, but if you have to send it out, and a lot of people send it out to private labs for testing that are accredited, I mean, it can cost, like I said, $1,000, $1,200 a sample. So it is a costly procedure.
As for how fast it can be done, it's obviously impossible. It depends on the resources of the jurisdiction. But I would be very curious to know how long it took the CIA or the military to do the DNA testing on Bin Laden when he was killed. And I would say that's probably as fast as it can be done.
Right. I mean, realistically, you can do it, in a matter of overnight or hours if you're just doing that one case, but that's not how it's done in practical application. What's happened is the samples are done in batches, so they run the batches every so often, and then they process them in huge batches. But if you have a high-profile case, and again, look at the case Matthew's talking about with Bin Laden. I mean, they had a DNA confirmation, I believe, by the next day, didn't they, Matthew, on that?
I wouldn't be surprised to hear it was a number of hours, but that's obviously nearly unlimited resources, that it's just you're pushing against what is possible with science. But Jason, just to kind of bring things, hopefully tie it together, I should add that the way that Bin Laden was actually identified is kind of a cousin of familial searching, which is one of the cutting-edge DNA techniques that David identified. It's kind of a backwards family tree where they're able to identify someone by virtue of a relative's DNA. And the Grim Sleeper case in Los Angeles was solved by it, and Bin Laden was identified because the U.S. had a DNA sample from his sister, and they determined that, again, this person in Abbottabad, Pakistan, had nearly identical DNA profile to someone who they knew to be his sister. So, again, it's very, very interesting that that happened also in the 25th year of DNA forensics and that all this stuff is really continuing to unfold. It's going to be different 5-10 years from now, the same way that it's the state of the science is different than it was 10 years ago when the cold case unit in Los Angeles was founded.
Well, Matthew, let's give you the last word. We've gone over time, but this has certainly been well worth it. David Lampkin, retired LAPD detective officer and founder of the LAPD cold case unit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Matthew McGough.
Thank you, Jason.
You're the cover story of Miller McCune magazine out this month. Thank you both, and let's do it again sometime.